Lena Morris, and I am doing the third session in a series that I've been calling Balancing. Are you all able to hear? If not, please speak up as I go, because I know how miserable it is if you can't hear. I have been trying to propose a way of looking at your life so that when you come to transitions or turning points in your life, you have a way of thinking that allows you to do some practical planning. Because the longer we live, the more of those turning points we are likely to have. And I talked the first time about the fact that we are sensing that people today need to go through a questioning period, every 5, 7, 10 years. It depends on the person, and it depends on what has caused it. Sometimes these turning points or transitions are caused by the simple developmental needs that we go through as an adult. Sometimes it happens because of some kind of external event, such as a health crisis or a financial crisis, the death of someone, that kind of thing that forces us to do a reassessment and redesign. But sometimes it's simply because we are at a point in our life, sometimes near the end of the 20s and again somewhere in the middle of the 40s, early 40s, late 40s, sometimes again in the 50s, but that certainly we all have to sort of know how to go about that, because whether it's caused by external events or adult development transitions, there comes a point when you have to say to yourself, who am I now? And what is right for the next stage of my life? And when you ask yourself that very profound question of what is right for me, then you have to settle down and do some very hard thinking. And I don't know if you share the distress that I have felt in my life when I am faced with one of these transitions. Do you want to just sit right on here? Would you like to just sit right here? You're going to go up? All right. I am often frustrated when I've had to answer this, because I had always been told that you need to know yourself. Know thyself, and to thine own self be true. And live the examined life. You know, we've been given these exhortations, but I always kept saying, how do you do this? You know, I'm sort of a practical how-to person, and it always bothered me that I didn't get any instructions. And I had this mental image that in order to know yourself, you had to sit on top of a mountain and hope that great messages would fall down. And I didn't know whether I just wasn't the receptive sort, but I didn't seem to get much in that way. So I, when pressed, I asked myself, what do I need to know? Maybe I'd better take responsibility for knowing myself. Maybe it's never going to come to me in an easy fashion. Maybe I'm going to have to work hard at this. And so as a way of thinking for myself, I devised this idea of thinking of myself as at least three different selves. The one is the individual self, which I sometimes call the self as being, the relationship self, which is the self with others, and the life work self, which is the self in action, or the self doing. And in each case here, I'm not trying to imply they're at all separate. In fact, they're totally one, of course. But the energies that you get from one self, of course, feed or drain the others. We're all terribly complex. And the interlocking of these different selves must never be underrated. But nonetheless, just as a way of thinking, this enabled me, at least, to sort out who am I when I need to. So what we have talked about in the past was the relationship self. And the idea was that to keep your life in some kind of balance, you have to say, I should be investing approximately, and this is, you know, you use numerical terms for something that isn't numerical, but you need to invest about a third of your life energies into simply growing up as an individual, as a human being, maturing as a person. Then you need to be thinking about investing about a third of your psychic energies and your physical energies in the relationship side of your life, and about a third in the work that you do. And that then you should have reasonable expectations that perhaps a third of your satisfactions will come from what it is you do, about a third of your satisfactions will come from your relationships, and at least a third of your satisfactions will simply come from enjoying the growth within yourself that you become, of which you become aware. Now, to look at your life this way, then you can say, what part of my life needs attention? Because I find that as we go through the different life stages, that usually there is one part of our life that we have had to concentrate on given that life stage. For instance, when I was at home with four small children, there was no question but that my relationship self was the most important part of myself in terms of the amount of time and energy invested, where my thoughts were, where my values were. I mean, I was very definitely over-invested, if you wish, in relationships at that time in my life. Sometimes when you're getting a career going, there's no question but that you are over-invested for a while in getting a paid job or making that career start in a good, healthy fashion. In fact, I find that our culture has encouraged men to over-invest in their paid work. They even neglect some community work and these other sources of satisfaction in the work life, and often get absolutely locked into the paid job to the exclusion of the other parts of their self. And women are often encouraged to overinvest in partner and family to the point where they get unrealistic expectations as to how much happiness and how much satisfaction is available from partner and family. And yet, when they do that, two things happen. If a man overinvests here, and unfortunately some of our women are now doing this too, in the paid job, they are terribly vulnerable when they lose their job. Because not only have they put a lot of investment in here, they might have, as their only relationships of any substance, their colleagues. And so if they lose their job, they not only lose this piece of themselves, but they lose this also. And it is so necessary in order to be able to live well through all the different decades of life, to be constantly aware of all different parts of yourself and to be nurturing all three selves. Now, I've just given a very brief summary here, but the only other point I'd like to make of these two before I move on to the one that we're talking about tonight is that within the relationship self, I think it is so important to both have the selves in some kind of balance, but also to be balancing the investment in partner and family and in friends. I think friends are vastly underrated in our society, and yet as we get into our later decades particularly, it is critical that we know how to make new friends, how to develop new relationships, that we are constantly investing here and expanding, that we honor and respect the support people and the groups in our lives, and to cultivate support groups, such as in our churches and in our neighborhoods and things, so that we do continue to have a sense of community. And over here in the life work, we were making the point that we have to keep a balance within this too, so that perhaps we can get the satisfactions we need from some combination of a paid job and the work we do in the community, or the work we do in the community and the work we do in the home, or some combination of these. That we need to be realistic about how much satisfaction is available to us from any one little piece of this pie. But now to concentrate on what I wanted to present tonight, this whole issue of the individual self, I think, is a fascinating one. I am talking here more about how we spend our time and energy than I am talking about our basic attitudes. Because you notice in the center, I have the word values. Now, I use my material with all kinds of groups. I do a lot of my work with business people. And so I have to use terminology and words that do not turn them off, if you will. This is what I call the spiritual base. This is your belief system, which is at the heart of everything. It spills out into your relationships. It determines how you do your work. And it is certainly at the heart of who you are as a person. But this core is talking about the belief system. This is talking about how you spend your time and energy. And so I do want you to understand that I am not talking about spiritual life as simply one little segment of life. It is at the heart of life, of course. But I'm talking about what you do in the way of spiritual activities. All right, I'd like to spend a little time then this evening talking about each of these subdivisions within the individual self. Not because this is definitive by any means, it's simply a way of looking at it, a way of thinking. But I think that the basic approach has to be that we be committed to growth, that we recommend to ourselves, if you will, growth, that we want to be learning new things about ourselves, that we want to be truly committed to becoming the kind of people that God wanted us to be. And when we were created, He gave us certain gifts, certain talents, certain potential. And to really take seriously who we are able to be, I think, is the heart of this. So that when I look at these different divisions, I look at the physical self. And I grieve when I look at our society. Because no matter who I am talking to in my counseling, I find that most people don't like their physical self. We have been carefully taught in our culture to disrespect our physical self, especially is that true of women. I can have the most gorgeous woman in the world sitting there for counseling, and when I get right down to the root of the problem, she has a great physical insecurity. She doesn't like how she looks. She doesn't like the way her body is shaped. She doesn't like her nose. She doesn't like this. She doesn't like that. And of course, she didn't come to this by accident. Insecurity sells. We now spend more on cosmetics than on all of education together. Now, I'm going to repeat that so you grab hold of how insecure we are. We now spend more on cosmetics than on all of education. Now, don't despair. They are now starting on the men. Now they're going to make the men insecure. So pretty soon, maybe cosmetics will pass the national defense budget. Who knows? But meanwhile, that one of the aims here is that we learn to become comfortable with our physical selves. I am who I am, who I am. And I like the way I look. And I'm not going to spend a lot of psychological energy or time and physical energy on worrying about how I look. Now, my friend Willa Hiltner, you know, wants me to go out and run every day. And I say, well, Willa, I don't know about that time. If you're going to want me to look after my shape, it's going to have to be in 20 minutes. And we always have this sort of running battle. But I said, you know, everybody in my family looks a little dumpy, so I plan on continuing that way. And we have this sort of interesting discussion, but I really mean it. I'm not going to spend my time worrying about it. So every time I see an ad for Weight Watchers or something, I put big black marks through it, you know, just to let them know what I think about it. I don't go for it. And I simply, when I see these ads that talk about wrinkles, you know, and all these kind of things, I just make up my mind I will never buy that product under any circumstance. I will not be intimidated. I am who I am, who I am. Now, that doesn't mean to say I don't like to look attractive. I try my best every day, but I'm not going to let it control me. And I do believe that as we get older in our society, in a society that doesn't like us to have wrinkles, we really have to come to grips with this issue. And I think it's very necessary. The next thing we have to do is to take responsibility for our physical self. So for so many years, we really have looked to doctors to look after us. And they have really sort of taken over the task of deciding whether we're healthy or well. And we have really given it to them. We've asked them to define whether we are sick or well. We have to take responsibility for our physical self in the sense that we need to know our bodies, to know when we are under stress, to recognize that we must be good to ourselves, we must look after our diets, we must look after ourselves in that profound way, and to know our bodies so that when we are sick, we know it. We don't have to go and have a whole batch of tests every time. We can pay attention. And we can take the responsibility upon ourselves instead of being sort of passive victims. I think there has been a real tendency on our part to abdicate that. And it was so fascinating for me to live over in Borneo, where I was the head of a Chinese school for a while, to find out that every Chinese student there knew, and I say that because it was a kind of intuitive knowing, their bodies. And they were very aware of the energy sources in their body. They were very conscious of how they were designed. They were in awe of the complexities and mysteries of their body, and they took the time to know. And so it's fascinating for me, for instance, as I work with employees and companies, to discover that people will come to you and they'll say they've been having habitual headaches. And when you try to talk to them about what might be behind it, they say, well, my doctor has no idea. I'll say, well, don't you have any ideas? Well, no, I've been to doctors all over town. I'll say, but they don't know anything. I mean, what do you know? I mean, they can't tell you what's going on beyond saying, well, you don't have any tumors, and physiologically, I can't find anything wrong with you. I mean, where is your responsibility, my friend, to track down where those headaches are coming from? So that is one of the things that I am finding is really exciting at this time. We are paying attention and taking responsibility for our physical selves, and we are not worrying so much, or I hope we're not worrying so much, although I have to tell you that I see our young girls, especially, truly tyrannized. I don't know what other word to use but tyrannized. Try to keep your young women from reading these ghastly magazines that are nothing but a series of ads and a series of articles to make them feel inadequate. It is really awful what we do to our young girls. Moving on to the intellectual self. I think one of the things that I, as a career counselor, am so aware of is that many people see learning as something that they did when they were kids. And they really are not aware of how they must stay intellectually alert in order to be competitive in the marketplace. Things are moving so quickly, and the skills required in this world are changing so rapidly that we ought to be very careful about letting ourselves become obsolete. I feel that everybody, no matter what age they are, needs to really ask, how can I keep current? How can I be developing a new set of skills at any time in my life? Both knowledge and doing skills. So that whenever you are at a transition point in your life, you always have a plan B in mind. I don't think anybody today, whatever age, can really be without a plan B. That is, if this script that I'm living out right now needs to be changed, either because I want to change it or because I have to change it, do I have an option well in mind? Am I taking a class in something else? Am I learning a set of new skills that are more applicable today to today's workforce? Am I learning new work skills and new things that I could use in my community work? Am I learning new things that would be helpful to the people around me? Because I think that many of us confuse meaning well with being genuinely helpful. I can remember as a pastor's wife, I spent years counseling, and I now realize that I did a lot of harm. Why? Because I didn't have any counseling skills. I only meant well. And you know, somebody who means well is a dangerous person. And because sometimes I just handled it so badly that I know I handicapped people's growth. Why? Because I was so supportive, so understanding, so kind, that I often didn't tell them to get off their butts. Truly. I often did them harm by not calling a spade, because I didn't know how to do it. I didn't have the skills to be able to get to the heart of the matter and deal with it. And so I often would just sit and listen and listen and listen, when in fact they needed a very strong counselor. And in fact, I allowed them to stay crippled because I kept them just happy enough so they didn't have to face their realities. You know, I should have just let them bottom up. Many times we let meaning well substitute for competence. I did it for years, so I know it well. And sometimes we really do not want to do the hard work of becoming knowledgeable. Many times people come to me and they'll say, well, you know, I would like to get in thus or so career, but you know, I've been told that you really have to have this or this or this. And do you know any other ways of getting into that kind of occupation? And I'll say, my friend, I think you have some disciplined hard work to do. Now, that isn't what they want to hear. They want to know of some magical back door. And I have to say, there's a price to be paid. You really cannot substitute well-meaningness for knowledge and competence. And becoming intellectually disciplined. As we get older, many times people sort of go on hold as though nobody really expects older people to be up to date and current. In fact, in our society, there's sort of an implicit agreement that as you get older, you can become lesser. In fact, people assume you're going to be lesser. So it's very hard not to go along with the assumption and become lesser. So that many times people act old because people expect them to act old. And they stop reading tough textbooks, they stop really disciplining themselves in a certain intellectual field because nobody expects them to, and therefore they don't expect it of themselves, and so pretty soon they think they can't do it. Some of you that were here the first time heard about my aunt in Iceland. And I repeat this story a little bit because she was, without a doubt, a role model for me. She lived to be 108. And at least up until 106, she was very, very sharp intellectually. In fact, she got sharper each year she was alive. And she read and she underlined and she made notes. And when she watched TV, she argued with them. I mean, there was no hesitation on her part. She knew, and she knew that she knew. Now, I guess she was rather obnoxious, but she sure wasn't bland. And I think this is one of those things that we have to say, I intend to keep learning as long as I live, and I'm going to make sure that I know what I'm talking about so that I can enter in with confidence. And I think that this is one of those disciplines we have to accept. Then I would like to talk a little bit about the emotional growth that many of us have to work with. As I work with people in terms of getting jobs and developing their careers, I discover that those that have the most trouble in their careers are often technically competent. They know what they're doing, but they can't get along with people. And those that do move ahead and those who do have, and I don't mean moving ahead necessarily going up any ladder, but I mean moving ahead in the best sense of the word of really being contributing workers in the society, are people who really do love people and know how to work well with people and are able to communicate well with them and have developed a kind of emotional maturity to go along with their skills. But developing an emotional maturity is something that is hard won for most of us. And many of us have not really accepted the premise that we are responsible for how we feel. That at a very profound level, we choose how we feel. Now, I got all the way to age 43 before I accepted the responsibility of this. And until that point, I really felt that I was the victim, the passive victim of my emotions. So that if I was feeling down, you know, I just said, well, I'm feeling sort of blue today. Or if someone did something awful, and I felt hurt, I felt rejected, I felt disappointed, all those kind of things, or I felt angry and resentful, I often excused myself. I would say, well, you know, if somebody does something like that, I mean, you can't help it. I mean, somebody does something awful to you, you can't help how you feel. I mean, that's dreadful. I'll have to tell you the turning point, because it really was a remarkable moment in my life. Being a pastor's wife, and my husband has over the years been very controversial, And being in parishes where a lot of people thought he was getting into things that he ought not to get into, they would often be very critical. But because he's a rather large man and rather formidable at times, they didn't often, you know, eyeball him with their criticisms. Instead, they would often catch me in the narthex. And they would tell me what they didn't like about what he was doing. And like a silly lady, I took it to heart. And they would say these things and tell me all these things they didn't like. And I would go, oh dear, how can I solve this? How can I make so-and-so happy? How can I try and smooth this over? How can I help this? I mean, and I would just really take all these criticisms to heart. And they often didn't like me either. So I would often get a lot of this stuff and I would, you know, absorb all this stuff. And I mean, it was really enough to get you down. And it did get me down. And then one beautiful night, after having had a really difficult time with a woman I shall call Mrs. Peterson, with apologies to any who are named that right now, I don't know about you, but if I'm bothered about something, really distressed about something, I always go to sleep. I'm one who always sleeps. But if I'm disturbed, I wake up 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and I sit bolt upright. And whatever it is that's bothering me is right there to be worried over. Well, that's what happened this night. I woke up around 3 o'clock in the morning and there was Mrs. Peterson hovering over the bed. And I immediately started to think of ways to pacify Mrs. Peterson, ways to deal with this situation, all the time feeling this terrible hurt because she had said some very bad things. And I was going into my usual stew. And then all of a sudden, it was as if a voice spoke and said, "You know what, Alina? Mrs. Peterson is in charge of your life. She is in charge of how you're going to feel tomorrow. Mrs. Peterson is in charge of how you will look tomorrow. I mean, Mrs. Peterson is winning twice." Now, I wish I could tell you that I went through a forgiveness episode. I have to be honest with you and say I was just mad. I said, why would I let Mrs. Peterson control my life when I don't even like Mrs. Peterson? I mean, I cannot stop her from saying what she will say. I can't stop her from doing what she will do. But I certainly can stop me from reacting this way. I don't have to use up my energy on this. I am choosing to be hurt. I am choosing to be resentful. And I am choosing to give up my energy to Mrs. Peterson. Nobody is making me feel this way. I am choosing to invest my energies this way. And you say, oh, come on. I mean, if somebody does something mean to you, of course you are angry. Of course you're resentful. The answer is, yes, that's true. The question is, for how long? For how long? I have counseled a woman who told me that she had been in depression for 11 years. And I said, what's been going on? Well, she said, on my wedding day, if you can believe it, my mother-in-law said thus and thus and thus and thus. And she said, and ever since then, I have really been having a hard time. I said, how long have you been married again? She said, 11 years. I said, why would you let your mother-in-law control you for 11 years? She said, what do you mean? I said, my goodness, my friend, yes, she said this. It does sound like it was a terrible thing. But you're choosing to let this impact you for 11 years. Why are you doing this? Why, she said, you can't help it. I said, wrong? You're choosing to let her control your life. You say, well, that's easier said than done. You bet, it's the hardest thing I have ever learned. But I have learned the hard way because I cannot let my energy be drained in this fashion. I need it for more important things. I can't be debilitated by resentment and anger and negative feelings. I simply can't afford it. Why? I get exhausted by those things. And I don't know how anybody raises teenagers without learning this. I learned it just in time for the last two. Well, I mean, you really have to learn this, that they will do what they will do. I mean, you do your level best to raise them, and if you know that you gave it your best try, I mean, you know that you goofed. I know I goofed. But I can't do it over. So am I going to spend a lot of energy moaning over it? Well, I suppose I can. Goodness knows I do. But I'm sure cutting back on it. Because I say to myself, well, certainly, Elena, you can continue on till you're 90 feeling bad about some of your mistakes. I mean, you can whip yourself as long as you choose. But then, of course, you won't have any energy to help anybody else because you'll be so drained from your own guilt. When are you going to forgive yourself like you forgive other people? When are you going to choose emotional health? Now, I'm not talking about people who are coping with honest-to-goodness mental illness. That's another story. Although we really don't yet understand the close linkages between how we choose to feel and emotional illness. I don't pretend to know that fine line, and I don't think many people do. But I do know that we have to learn, if we're going to be living in a tough world, to be able to step back and say, how much energy do I want to invest here? Now, what was fascinating is that when I got over feeling victimized by Mrs. Peterson, I could forgive her. Because when she no longer controlled my emotions, I could be more objective about the situation and see my part in it. And I could realize that what I was dealing with here was a lot of pain and a lot of disillusionment and a lot of other stuff that I could help her with. And it's so interesting that when somebody can no longer manipulate your feelings, they quit trying. And then we got on a healthier basis in which she was not trying to manipulate me because she couldn't. And then I could be more open to her, and the whole thing got on a healthier basis, and she could forgive me, and I could forgive her, and the whole thing got, well, not really exciting, but at least tolerable. And I wondered why nobody had taught me this earlier, because, you see, I was raised to think that it was good to be sensitive. I mean, I almost cultivated it because it was almost a mark of being a very fine person to be sensitive. And it's like any other virtue that is taken to its extreme, it becomes your weakness. And many people say, well, I don't want to get hard-boiled. I'm not talking about hard-boiled. I'm talking about realistic. I'm talking about understanding. I'm talking about being empathetic. But I'm talking about being in charge of your own life so that you don't play victim. My, that is something that I wish all our young people could be taught. It's one of those life skills that once you see it, you wonder how you could have missed it. But it was easy to do, and I still find myself struggling. I suspect I will struggle with it till the day I die. But at least I don't let myself off the hook. Then I think the other part of this section, the spiritual piece of the individual self or the personal self, somehow that part of me is becoming more and more interesting as I get older. Because as I get older, I know less and less. And I am finding that my curiosity about things spiritual is becoming ever greater with each year of my life, but that I am becoming much more open-minded. I used to think I knew a lot. Now I don't know very much at all. I am now paying very close attention to many different ways of knowing spiritually. I used to be too much in the head, too much intellectual exercising, and not enough respect for the intuitive knowing that is at the heart of the spiritual. So that I find that I have to reject the tendency to hang on to outmoded truth. And I say that it was true for me at one time in my life, so it was not an untruth. But as I learn to know the world and myself, I need a new spiritual truth. I need a spiritual message for who I am today. And I find that the hardest people that I have to counsel are those who are still on what I call the Sunday school level of religious belief. That is, they got some simple answers when they were young, and they really have not done the hard work of spiritual exploration since. They have not questioned, they have not doubted, they have not struggled, because they have been told that it was a virtue not to do these things. And yet, the simple answers don't work when you get older. And therefore, you go into the usual pattern then is that as you get older, and if you really haven't taken responsibility for investigating what it is you really believe and what the scriptures have to say to you now and what all this means in terms of your overall life, most of us, and I have experienced this, come to a life crisis and we go through a period of what might be called a period of disenchantment. And I use the word disenchantment because we were living on a childish understanding of the faith. And so when we get into adult struggles, those childish beliefs don't hold water. They don't hang in there for us. And many times you simply have to say, "Dear Lord, help me as I struggle." And to accept the need to doubt, to accept the need to question, to look into the different ways of understanding spiritual truth. I think we Lutherans particularly, and I was a Methodist until I married a man who was going to be a Lutheran clergyman, and I thought it was going to be a little difficult for us to go to separate churches. I do believe that one of the things about the Lutheran Church that is both our strength and our weakness is that we do have a rigorous kind of intellectual discipline within the church, but at the same time we can make that intellectual, I believe, that intellectual statement, if you will, I believe, become a substitute for a knowing on a profound level, the experiential knowing. So that as I get older, I have been seeking out more and more the experiential, the knowing in other ways, and validating those knowings. And I don't know how to put this without sounding a little strange, but I have known, but I have not known that I knew. So that it became a kind of self-confidence that some of the things that I knew at a profound level but which I could not articulate in words were no less true because I didn't have the words for them. But one of the things that helped me so much too was living overseas and making it my business to study all the different world religions and to be able to know what the great thinkers through the ages had thought on the subject, and to read the poets and to read the dramatists and to, you know, look for all kinds of spiritual truth and spiritual understanding. What it did was to make my own Christian faith much stronger. But until I had explored the other ways of thinking and knowing, I didn't even know the treasure I had. So that it has been a great celebration to go through this kind of doubting and questioning and exploration and learning. But what is fascinating to me is that each time I have gone through some kind of a life transition, I have been called upon to struggle and to go through a real valley of pain. And I know that we're all built differently, so that some people go through these transitions with much more awkwardness, if you will, than others. But I do think that all of us have to be willing to feel pain. We were talking a little bit at 5 o'clock as to how do people learn. Well, I know how I learn. I learn when I have to learn. In fact, we had a little sign up in our counseling center, when do people change? And the answer on the other wall was, when they have to, and not 1 minute earlier. And I know that's been true with me. When you feel yourself going into a transition period, when you're asking, who am I? Who am I now? And what is right for me to do in the way of planning the next stage of my life? Don't be afraid of pain. In our culture, pain has been seen as bad. Pain has been seen as a negative. So that if you go into the doctors, most doctors, not all, because many doctors are becoming much more aware of this now, but many doctors would give you a pill. I mean, you could have your pain subdued with a Valium or something. Or many of us, when we start to feel pain, start to watch TV or some other kind of narcotic, playing bridge, you know, some of these things that you can do without thinking too much. I don't mean to put down bridge, but that's another one of those things that doesn't get you anywhere but makes you think you're working. But I think that we really have been afraid of pain. And so we'll hide. And many things in society will help us hide. And of course, we know that's one of the main reasons why we drink, usually, is to try and hide from pain. But if we can accept what St. Augustine said, there will be periods of divine discontent. So that when you start to feel real pain in your life, say, what is this pain trying to tell me? Obviously, it is time to change my perspective on life. It is time for me to grow. It is obviously time for me to redesign and to welcome the pain, not in a kind of a sick fashion, I don't mean that, but simply to know that pain is a signal for change and growth, and to recognize that you're going to have to struggle and dig in your heels and fight. I find, for instance, in relationships, as I was looking at all these different segments of life, I have recognized that on each one of these sections, when I have had to go through another life stage, I've realized that many times it required a renegotiation. As I was going past one life stage, I was experiencing a kind of dying. That certain things that I believed, certain things that I knew, certain things that I had done, certain people in my life were ending. And the pain of all that losing, that loss, and that ending was hard to put up with, hard to bear. But if we can remember something about that, and we all know this in the resurrection story, that as you finish a life stage, and whether it is ending, as I mentioned earlier, because of external events that are forcing that stage to end, or simply because in the natural scheme of adult development you are ending a time in your life, you should expect to go through what I call chaos, which in the old Greek means a period of nothingness. Because out of chaos is creation born. And until the old has ended, the new doesn't have a chance to be heard and to be nurtured and to grow. And so many of us get frightened by this chaos because, especially in an activist culture, nothingness is worse than turmoil. And many of us are more frightened by having to patiently wait for the hints and the clues as to what God wants us to do next. And yet I am convinced that whether it is a relationship that feels like it's dying, or whether it's a career that is petering out or no longer fascinating, or whether it is any kind of an ending that we're experiencing, we have to say, Lord, give me patience and give me courage to struggle with this so that I am true to who I can be. So that we can find a new way to relate to the person that we love. So that we can find new friends for the next stage of our life. So that we can find a new way of using our skills and our talents. So that we literally go through a death and rebirth experience in our life every time we ask, who am I now, Lord? And I have to say to you that it is, you've all experienced this. I'm not telling you things that you don't know. But I just also know that it brings about an incredible awareness if you are willing to go into the valley. I'll tell you just one story here at the end and then open it up if there's a minute or two. But I simply state this because it is a kind of testimony that I feel I sometimes have to give because of the world that we're living in right now. Living over in Southeast Asia as an American and from 65 to 69 was not an easy thing. I found out what it was like to be hated simply because I was an American. In Southeast Asia during that time, I could stand in a store and not be waited on. This blonde, blue-eyed person found out what it was like to be disliked, not for what I did, but for what I looked like. And I was so distressed by this experience of not being liked that I sent back to the Yale School of Far Eastern Studies to find out how on earth we as a nation had gotten involved in Vietnam. And I went through a terrible turmoil. When those books came and I read them from cover to cover, trying to understand how this had come about, I remember very clearly reading all night because I'm an obsessive reader. And I go through day and night when I'm interested. And it was 6 o'clock in the morning, and I had finished the last book. And I said, all right, now I know it all, and I don't know anything. Because I've read all this, and it is less intelligible to me than ever. And I said, what is going on here? And I realized at a very profound level that good people had made those decisions. And yet they were coming out of a different reality than I was. That somehow these good people had made these decisions. And it had resulted in a terrible evil. And I asked myself, what am I doing trying to raise my children according to Christian beliefs and dedicating my life to investing in these children that I'm teaching in this school in Borneo, when in fact they're going to have to go out into a world in which the very values that I'm teaching them are disregarded. Obviously, the people who are making these decisions are coming out of a different value base. But then I had to say to myself, but Elena, you have not done one thing. You have felt that as if you raised your own children right, that that was your contribution to society. And that if you did a good job of that, you were making your contribution to the next generation. And then I realized there will not be a world there for you, these children that you've worked so hard to raise, unless you become invested and involved in the decision-making when you get back home. And at that point, I became activated. I knew that there was not a one of us that could afford to have personal Christian values and not worry about what was going on in our society. And yet, when I came back to Illinois, and I went back to graduate school in DeKalb, I went around to parishes, talking to them about what was really going on in Southeast Asia. And it was an incredible experience, because nobody wanted to hear. And I led a Mother's Day March for Peace. And the women in some of the Lutheran churches in DeKalb spat on me. And I kept saying, what is it with our church people if they do not grow, if they do not deal with the world as it is? And I recognized my own part in it. It is so much easier not to grow. And I say this in love because I see it in myself every day. The real desire to withdraw, to prune my roses, to put my music on the stereo and not think too much about hard things. And yet I'm convinced that it is this self that we simply must respect and struggle with and insist that we take responsibility for ourselves and our emotions and our spiritual life and move ahead. Are there questions or clarifications or issues that you'd like to raise? Go right ahead.
You mentioned our involvement in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced that that was bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what bothers me more than anything? Where are the Jain populace and the people of that period that do not condemn the Russians that are in Afghanistan? Now, when you answer that, I'll be able to understand the rest. Where is that group?
Well, I'm not holding any brief for any individual.
I
feel that what has to happen is a literal transformation of how we view the world and how we view our responsibility to it. And I think it was very interesting to see the World Council of Churches up in Vancouver, where they were making the statement that, you know, nobody is right or wrong here. It requires a totally new way of thinking. And all I'm saying is that for so many years, I, as a Christian woman, did not see that I had a double responsibility to both raise, be responsible to my family, and be an active participant in society. I genuinely felt that if I was a good Christian within my family, I was doing my work. And I had to learn the hard way that if I don't take part in the decision making, I have nothing to say. You know, if I'm not actively working in it, then I better keep my mouth shut.
Well,
So I became an active worker. Yeah. Now I have, I hear you loud and clear, and your point is well taken. I just feel that as Christians, we are in a very critical time. You know, Arthur Clarke says that we are standing on the edge of history, in which we can either go back into a terrible dark age or leap forward into a new renaissance. And I really feel that we are walking along a very fine line. And I just feel that for many of us Christians, it has been too easy to make it a personal, private kind of faith. And because we haven't wanted the pain involved in dealing with the real issues. I look out of here and I see all you people who have gone through many more valleys than I have, and I feel a little presumptuous to be talking this way. Because I know that anybody who is here who has made the effort to come to this kind of a gathering has already made some very strong life struggles, or you would have given up long ago. So I address that with respect. Yes?
Do you feel that the World Council of Churches is doing a good job today?
Oh, I think given all the political realities where they have to walk very carefully to allow everybody to stay in it. I really feel it is a very dynamic group. I didn't get up there, but I really do feel that they are one of our best hopes, because there is no other vehicle that has representatives in all the countries that comes out of the same value base. Now, given all the troubles that any international group will have, I still have great confidence in their ability to cause things to happen. Especially, I think there was great hope up in Vancouver. I mean, I haven't liked all the things they've done in the past, but I really feel there was a spirit there, from what I've heard.
May I say something?
Absolutely.
2 years ago, we were given a book, we were here 2 years ago, and the book we were reading then was Compassion by Matthew Fox.
Yes.
And it impressed me tremendously because it introduced me to a new concept of living as against, and it used biblical quotations to support the idea of Sarah's circle. That would be cooperation.
Yeah.
Dancing circle.
Yes, I hear.
As against the ladder, Jacob's ladder, which is climbing.
Right.
I didn't hear all your seminar, but if you're a career advisor, aren't you kind of supporting the system of ladder in this society?
No.
I'm just saying that.
No, I'm not against ladders.
That's competition.
I think. I do think that the adversarial mode is dead. It doesn't know it yet, but it's dead. I think that when I talk about people's careers, I'm talking about people finding a life work, a work in which they can make a significant impact, a work to which they are committed, a work to which they can give an excellent effort. And sometimes that means going up, because we do need leaders. And I am hungry, I am absolutely hungry for leaders who have this sense of vision and can articulate to us how we can get to a new way of living and working. So I'm not against climbing ladders into positions of power, because in a vacuum of leadership, in a vacuum of power, somebody else will step in and the evil will win by the sheer absence of power, powerful good. But on the other hand, I see careers as being much broader than going up. Some of the people with the greatest careers have so-called been at the bottom of the ladder. All right, my friends.